Good evening. And welcome to the fifth event in this year's English Department Reading Series. Tonight, it is my pleasure to introduce poet Patrick Rosal, who grew up in northern New Jersey and took his MFA from Sarah Lawrence. His first book won the 2004 Members' Choice Award from the Asian American Writers Workshop. Pat's work came to my attention several years ago when an editor at Perse, my former student, Gabriel Freed, passed on a copy of that first book, Up Rock, Head Spin, Scramble, and Dive. The delight that reading and rereading it gave me lingers, which is, I suppose, one mark of an excellent book and of a serious and also incandescent talent. It's customary, if maybe tiresome, for poets of my age to identify the various flavors they taste in new poetry they run across and admire. I'll do so, since it may be revealing, and it indicates the kind of company Pat Rosal puts me in mind of, just staying in New Jersey and its environs. In that first book, I could hear William Carlos Williams and Frank O'Hara and early Amiri Baraka, a.k.a. Leroy Jones, informing Pat's sound and his technique. But I also heard a young man of both sincere and authentic courage, writing with tremendous verve into the heart of his experience, growing up, contending with rage, with regret, with ravishment. And he was doing so for keeps, not for show. This poet, whose gifts deepened with his second book, My American Kundiman, which I and my advanced workshop read and talked about with similar delight this past fall. If themes of heritage, family life, and mixed feelings about America give a somewhat more meditative cast to this new work, the poems still carry a stunning charge. We are indeed fortunate that Pat has come all the way up from Austin, Texas, where he is currently teaching, to read to us tonight. Please welcome Patrick Rosal.
Thanks, Rob. Thank you, snow. I feel good about snow because this is my first winter without snow, so I'm like, I was telling Rob I have a romantic relationship with the winter for the next 24 hours, and then I get to go back. You know, I was just telling Matt O'Donnell that I've been doing this for more than a decade at this point, going out and giving readings all over the country, and for a decade, My palms still sweat and my voice still shakes before I do this. I mean, part of it is because no matter where I go, the audiences are different. You just don't know what to expect. You know, in New York, for example, I'm certain that that people are going to be, you know, really kind of vocally responsive. So feel free to applaud after every poem, or throw cash. I'll take that too. So I'm going to go in chronological order, and I'm going to read from Up Rock first, and then My American Kundiman, and if it doesn't get too crazy, I'm probably going to read a few pieces from the newest collection that I've been working on, and then I'd be happy to take some questions. That's cool at the end too. We can have a conversation. I have I have an ex whose name is Isa. And she called me up one day to tell me, I was living in Pennsylvania, she was back in New York. She called me to tell me that someone in her grad program told her that her name, Isa, means where in Madagascar. I said, so? She said, I think you should write a poem about it. I said, no. Here's the poem. Isa. Where? Your name means where in Madagascar? The question a man breathes along the hips of his wife in the bony dark of Tuliara. Where? Your name means where in Madagascar, and so should be written in Malagasy, Bisaya, Creole, but not here. Here, your hair spills on my lap like a thief's riches, and your hands a pair of clumsy blessings somewhere at the end of your body. Here are broken bottles and odd copper coins, as if I should compare them to your eyes. Here, you become a mouth full of mango and salt, which makes me crave the surf and speak the word, which is a question on an island where children dream of never finding the same path back. Your name is on their lips. You might say, we are ancestors to a race of beings who will understand the sea is your own tongue or heart or anything we suspect is partly human, and they will know to sail into it, you have to risk drowning, though none of us knows when or where. Your name means where in Madagascar to the man breathing along the hips of his wife. Your name, a litany for those in the dark who love to lose their way. That's right. That's right. You got it. You got it. So, when the winter breaks in New York, which is usually a few weeks before it breaks here, it's a beautiful thing. And this is an account of what the first spring feeling day is like in New York City. Citrus City. When I walk down 2nd Avenue, the first sun-spent day of spring, and the scent of dropped flowers, spilled bottles of OE, and mints begins to burn from the asphalt. And people stripped to the waist, reminded of some first urge to be naked against the city air. 8 million breaths at any given moment. I see a boy devour the last slice of an orange, and my mouth waters. So I buy one for myself at the closest stand. The citrus drips down my wrists from the corners of my lips, and I realize it's been some time since this joy, since I've peeled and eaten an orange on the street, and it's been some time since I've seen anyone eat an orange outside. I look into the eyes of Manhattanites who look me in the mouth, and I think perhaps she tastes the same tart under her tongue, and maybe she will head straight for a fruit stand and buy a navel to eat on the street too. And someone will see her, or two people will see her, love her skirt sprayed with a minuscule burst of juice, so they buy lots of oranges. Eat one on the bus, heading uptown toward all those oranges in the Bronx, and the person stepping off at 23rd walks cross town to Chelsea, surrenders his organic nut bar, stops at a fruit stand, and maybe someone on route to Chinatown bumps into the guy from Chelsea and remembers his first orange at a picnic as a child on a beach in the Philippines in August. So he buys two oranges, goes home to his lover whose drape of sweat smells like the day. And since he's already eaten one along the way, they sit across from each other and share the remaining one. It's packed flesh, a brief but cool reprieve from their apartment steaming like an engine. And this is how a whole city is eating oranges. The first sun-spent spring day, an orgy of them. I don't know if many of you know the poet Ross Gay. He came up to do, when did he read up a Bowdoin, Matt?
February.
So about a year ago. Amazing poet, and kind of one of those guys who has so many gifts you hate him. And we went to grad school together. Every Wednesday night in grad school, we would play basketball together, and that's actually how Ross and I ended up becoming good friends. We actually didn't read each other's poems until after he had finished his MFA over at Sarah Lawrence. This is about Ross. Beast. They call him Beast where he's from. And he will tell you that each living physical moment affords an opportunity to do something unique and beautiful. Now clearly, this is a load of bullshit. You see, I first became acquainted with Beast's grunt and howl metaphysics at a dust-sucking half-court game every Wednesday night in grad school, when on several occasions, yes, I stripped the ball from him clean. Beautiful? No. That shit was ugly. And in the tradition of the many monsters who came before him, he did not cry for such ugliness. This beast is 6'4" and speaks 5 versions of pound and pummel in South Philly. I'm watching him play summer league, where Beast thinks he's a poet even when he hauls down a brick off the defensive boards and there's 4 other black men on the court calling to him, "Beast! Beast! Beast!" He answers them with all the sensitivity of a Cretic foot, a quick pivot midcourt that knocks the opponent's skinny two-guard off the gawky pair of iron skillets grown out of the poor kid's ankles and projects them like an old neurosis across the crud-ridden gym floor. More than once, I've caught Beast's blunt left-wing blade of his broad back on my chin and then with my best blacktop ineloquence cursed him. Thank you. Fuck you too. Isn't this so often the affection between men, that we should share not a single lovely word unless through a battered mandible? This is how I listened to Beast recite after those Wednesday nights his invented names for fire in such holy brag and trash, but also how one morning over tea, in a more muted bravado, he narrated the quiet trauma of his father's final weeks. How his old man, whose oak switch cruelty Beast had long survived, was shrunken down to a pair of scrawny wrists. How they yanked at the tethers to the gurney with whatever will he could scrape from his gut already nearing the end to its slow cook from his gut. Beast's father, conjuring one last good ass-whooping glare, would shake his head, pointing to his own mouth. He was signaling his son to remove the ventilator tube shoved a full foot down his rotting neck, every nerve in his failing body yowling soundlessly, "No, not this. I don't want this. Take the goddamn thing out." And Beast dutifully answered the way any noble animal must answer its closest kin, with his body, with the dangerous radius of his shoulders, with his muscled trunk, and with his breath. He watched the last of his father's silent, wide-eyed squawks and enacted a son's most loving disobedience. He held himself for hours there, perfectly still. The woman you love cuts apples for you. Takes place in London with a beautiful woman cutting apples. The woman you love cuts apples for you and stirs them in sea salt and vinegar. She takes a drag from her silk cut, eases again through the fruit's flesh, the blade stopping short of her thumb. You are both sweating at the shoulder, East Ham's hottest summer, and you realize these aren't the times to come to poetry. You have everything you need. Your father's bone-hard stare can't reach across the Atlantic, so you save yourself for another day, because there is this woman slicing apples, stirring them in vinegar, reminding you of an afternoon 25 years ago when you knelt with your brothers at your mother's feet to pluck apple slices from a small basin pinched between her legs. And one of you would lift that bowl almost completely empty, except for a sour, clouded liquid and a few seeds shifting at the bottom. You'd just taste it first, but soon you're handing it from brother to brother, gulping lungfuls of that tart cider. You'd sweat, sniffle, gasp, chug till your lips turned white and numb. And before you went out into those Jersey streets, you'd rinse your chin, you'd soap your hands, because the girls would hold their breath for every reason and stink on your fingers and neck. You won't dare tell anyone you've learned to love the taste of something so strange, until this woman cuts apples for you in vinegar, and the familiar fumes fill your nostrils and gullet. She will lift the bowl to drink. She'll twist her face and laugh when she offers it. And you will drink, and she will drink, and you will drink again. She will kiss your cut knuckle. She'll kiss your eyes. Of course, the vinegar stings. It's the hottest summer ever in London. And you and the woman you love fall asleep side by side like this, reeking and unwashed, breathing in each other's dreams of broken skin. This second book is the middle section. The book is called My American Kundiman, and this whole second section are Kundiman. Kundiman are kinds of Filipino love songs. Basically, they're usually sung from a man to a woman, and the guy is usually saying, I love you, and the woman is usually saying, I don't love you. So it's this song of unrequited love. Now, what happens at the end, towards the end of the 19th century during the Spanish occupation of the Philippines, is that Filipinos began to politicize the song. What I mean by that is they took this figure named Joselinang Baliwag, and they would sing this beautiful song about how much they love Joselinang Baliwag. And the occupational forces of Spain thought that Filipinos were singing to this woman, but all these praises that they were actually singing were to their occupied homeland. So it was a kind of a code. The song was a kind of a code. So the middle section of this poem are, they're essentially love songs for America. They're American Kundiman. This one's kind of a list Kundiman, a list poem. Kundiman ending on a theme from Tila Rock. Anybody know who Tila Rock is? Who's Tila Rock? Do you remember what his biggest hit was? His biggest hit was It's Yours, 1987. So, Kundiman ending on a theme from Tila Rock. Your mornings every day stained call of exhaust. Your plum bludgeon dust, your fine stench, your luckless French kiss, your can I get down bliss. Your God gone blessed Jones for loam, your Jersey Baroque, your Mercy Nine sirens prying every sky. Your name, your flow, your funk, your everyday nasty, your very revelry, your breakneck scat, the loot, your boost, your rags, your 7,000 island slang, your hype, your hips, your spit, your sickest wit and snip, your every severed syllable, your blunt toke tables, your smokes your levers torque bearing your body every day, every lovely mucking hum, your mic sound nice, every check one, your fade, your cut, your knife, your jazz on two, your bass, your every clef, your left breast, your folly, your lung, your modest rot, your Alibaba tongue, do you want it? Hell yeah, baby, because it's yours. No, you can't clap now, you stop. About the white boys who drove by a second time to throw a bucket of water on me. About the white boys who drove by a second time to throw a bucket of water on me. The first time, they merely spat on me and drove off. I stood there a while, staring down the road after them as if I were looking for myself. I even shouted my own name. But when they cruised past again to toss a full bucket of water and who knows what else on me, I charged, sopping wet after their car. And though they were quickly gone, I kept running. Maybe it was hot that August afternoon, but I ran the whole length of Main Street, past the Five and Dime, where I stole Spalding's and Rabbit's Feet, past the Raritan Bus Depot and Bo's Den, and the projects where Derek and them scared the shit out of that girl. I pummed the thin pistons of my legs all the way home. Let's get real. It's been 25 years, and I haven't stopped running. Through those side streets in Metuchen, each pickup b-ball game, every swanky midtown bar, I've looked for them in every white voice that slurred and cursed me with an earshot, in every pink and pretty body whose lights I wanted to punch out and did. To be honest, I looked for them in every set of thin lips I schemed to kiss, and this is how my impossible fury rose like stone in water. I ran all 7 miles home that day, and I've been running ever since, arriving finally here. And God damn it, I'm gonna set things straight. The moment they drove by, laughing at a slant-eyed yellow-backed gook, they must have seen a boy who would never become a man. We could say they were dead wrong. But instead, let's say this. Their fathers gave them their rage, as my father gave me mine. And from that summer day on, we managed to savor every bloody thing that belonged to us. It was a meal constantly replenished, a rich bitterness we learned to live on for so long, we forget how, like brothers, we put the first bite in one another's mouth. For my childhood friend, Derek, who first told me I could call him nigger. I don't know when the white kids in our neighborhood got permission to use it, or how they figured it was safe for them to say around me, for I wasn't one. Not dark enough, I mean, to scare their mothers, yet not cracker enough to date their sisters. Know this, I didn't think of you as black until the day you said I could call you nigger. You meant to say we were brothers, so know this too. Since that day, I have shouted this word inward and let it echo throughout the dim continent of my skull. I split it open with my bare hands like a plum and sucked its purple juice from my thumbs. I've cut it up into 11 pieces, rigged its razored gears, fermented it in my spleen to gin, and raised whole fields with it by blaze. What shouldn't a yellow boy like me know about a noun doused in 500 years of burning? What could I do when you poured its fire into my palms and said, take this, drink? And when did I learn to say it proud as a white boy? How did I put it then to my lips? How easy to love the turn of a single word's blade, cutting every which way at once. How's everybody doing? You sure? I am tearing through these poems, Rob. I was expecting this is going to be a much longer set. All right. So I hope y'all got a lot of questions. How many of you speak Spanish? Out of curiosity. How many of you really speak good Spanish? Because I have some people going like this. How many of you like are kind of learning? You kind of have some facility with language, and how many of you can kind of have like a reading comprehension of Spanish? How many of you speak more than one language? I'm curious. I feel like everybody should learn more than one language. I speak 4. What? Not good, but I speak them, right? My first language, of course, is, I was born and raised in Jersey, so my first language is English. I didn't learn, the Philippines has 80 plus distinct languages, 7,100 islands, more than 80 languages, truly a diverse people. But my second language, because I grew up in Jersey, was Spanish. I learned it in high school, but I got to use it in the streets, you know, when I was b-boying, and still to this day, it's the language of secrets in some ways between me and my son. That said, my father is also fluent in Spanish, but we never spoke Spanish to one another when I was growing up. I went to Buenos Aires. I rented an apartment out there one summer, and probably about 3 or 4 days into being in Buenos Aires, I called up my father, whom I don't have a great relationship with, but I just wanted to let him know that I was okay. And instinctively, because I had been speaking Spanish for a few days, I began speaking to him in Spanish. And he started speaking back to me in Spanish. And it was this first conversation that me and my father had ever had in Spanish with one another. And it started off almost like we were just kind of kidding each other because we had never heard each other speak Spanish directly to one another, right? And he always said that I spoke Spanish like a Puerto Rican, as if that were a bad thing, right? But me and my dad, we had this conversation. We stayed on the phone probably for a good, like, you know, 10 minutes or so. And there was not one bitter feeling between us. This is a language that he and I, we could love one another in this language because we had not been angry at one another the way that we had been angry at one another in English for so many years. The irony of this being that the Philippines was colonized by Spain for 400 years. So the very language of oppression of a nation for four centuries became the very language of connection between me and my father. Right? So that's what this poem is about. As glass. When these sons of Buenos Aires holler at me in chorus from across the street, in the formal idioms their fathers used to ignore the beggars of Recoleta and the ubiquitous feral dogs, I understand just enough to switch my bag of fruits from one hand to the other and put El Clarín between my elbow and my flab, then fling their summer-toughened leather ball back halfway to the field, and they all rush toward me to be the first to retrieve it. I go back to my hard floor flat in Palermo and phone my dad back in Jersey. Papa, I say. Of course, at first, he doesn't recognize his own name or even my voice. For I am speaking to him with an affection whose prepositions point in all the wrong directions. It's simple. We don't loathe one another in Spanish like we do in English. For once, we are laughing at the same time. From que hay hasta adios, we end by wishing each other to God. And the boys, I can still hear them teasing one another in Lunfardo down the street. Maybe they aren't too young to despise their fathers. Maybe they can already taste a petty venom distilling in their mouths in the prayers they pretend to say before they sleep. For the moment, I love my dad more in this Castilian, this dialect of conquerors, this larcenous parlance. I love him more than I will in English in the many years to come. In the American slang, I'd rather spit at his feet, the one I stutter into my lover's hair, the one boiled into my tendons. I'm eloquent in foolishness and rage. I should tell you what you don't yet know about my father's English. It rises from his ankles to his torso and limbs like molten glass. It stiffens when it cools, and this is why he and I can glare at one another for decades without moving. All the lexicons of sadness and delight fill the body, turning cold and hard around every muscle and bone, a crystalline filigree twisted around the capillaries and metacarpal nooks, stopping themselves in the esophagus, duplicating precisely the full lattice work of the unseen. So if flesh, sinew, and gut, this human crucible were to fall away as it must, what's left is the clear anatomy of a man's invisible within, cast in the most fragile human language, gone 77 years unsummoned. The whittled wooden fans of his childhood, calesas rocking over vegan cobblestone, hand-carved rosary beads, the curious Chicago cold, the solitary cough from a Brooklyn pew, soup and cots and elevators and burnt offerings and 400 years of horseshit poured hot through his veins. And I am there too. Sitting in a chilly apartment in Palermo, listening to the fading howls from the football field, the bold charity of a foreign tongue sweetening in my mind the image of this quickly aging man who used to whack me and my brothers silly with his leather belt. And every word of every tenderness I have failed to speak is already rising through my knees as glass. It is old and it is pure. It is not free of bitterness or grief. It is heating my very fingers as I write this. I want to learn to love more fluently, even if it means in English I should shatter into the body of my father. Poem. part of the complication between in the relationship with me and my father is that part of it really is ontological. My dad is an ex-Catholic priest. He was ordained on March 17th. That's how I got my name. St. Patrick. After the man they say chased the snakes out of Ireland, after the patron of the day my father was ordained into the church, he wanted me baptized with a word click shut like a trap. My name starts with the brittle snap, a kiln dried wood, and ends with a trick. It claims my skin, my flat nose, thick lips, the 11 ways I've kissed one woman asleep. When I die, I want my friends to christen me again, dab my head with oil, bless my lips with rum. I want them to give me a name they'll tag in alleys, chisel into rock, cracked in its side, a name as far from heaven as the next George Street bar. I want a name like a Luther Vandross slow jam, like a Kundiman, like a New Orleans double time march, something they can pour on the floor, stomp on with their shoes, grinding it to dust. I want them to dance to their God-forsaken feet turned blue. One more for this book, and then I'm going to finish with three. I'm going to try out three new poems. That's cool. So I am the. How many of you are the product of Catholic education? Don't be ashamed. We're not in church. How many of you had more than 6 years? Eight. How many had the full 12? How many the 12 plus kindergarten? Oh my God, I'm so sorry. I'm going to give you a prize. So I went to St. Francis Cathedral School in Metuchen. And after school, I didn't take the bus home. I had to wait for my dad to come pick us up for a couple of hours at the public library, which is across the street from the convent. And there was this room. There was a lot like this now that I'm thinking about it. In the public library on the second floor, but all the walls were blue, like these chairs, there was like blue carpet. And they would use this room on weekends to do like storytelling, like turn the page for little kids, right? But we would take chicks up there and make out with them. So this is my tribute to the blue room. I get really turned on in libraries now. Barnes & Noble. Can you edit that part out? The Blue Room. That was the year I first smelled a girl on my fingers. A consensus of sweat and blood and bloom. The same year, a skinny Polish kid and me turned a recess tussle into a year-long fight. Not long after I learned Hotel California on the guitar and squeaked a desperate chorus to every freckled schoolyard chick who'd listen. That was the first year I believed the white boys who bragged about all the sex they had. It seemed everything by then was a race. So there I was, still crouched at puberty's starting blocks, anxious to sprint toward that orangutan manhood of my own. Each afternoon at the library across the street from St. Francis Convent, where nuns without last names came and went, the ones who taught us to memorize the seven gifts of the Holy Spirit and to avoid the only two kinds of sin that mattered, mortal and fun. Carrie Ann, Jean, and I would loiter between stacks of big print novels and art book nudes, reclined in some French meadow. We hid behind racks of Boys' Life and Highlights, finally crept upstairs to an empty, lights-out, high-ceiling, high-windowed vault of a space where everything gave up its color for some vague shade of blue. Where she and I jammed our tongues into each other's mouths, more lost than lustful. Where I lifted her plaid skirt, and she goose-stepped out of her panties, and I pulled down her bra to taste her nipples, pink and perk between my lips, of course. I didn't want to. I had to. What could be more Catholic? Sometimes I wonder what's become of that strong-thighed, half-French, half-Irish gymnast who let me for 1 year in the blue room of the public library slow jam and slop kiss her from neck to hip. The two of us dodging the few beams of afternoon that lit the slant columns of dust our bodies unsettled until we emerged into the full light, back downstairs to the other kids, her friends in one corner and the white boys in another, waiting hungrily to sniff the what was it like musk of my hands and inhale from my fingers the perfume of a future they swore they already knew. I'm going to close with three poems from the new book, one short, one long, and then another one that's pretty quick. Race doesn't figure a whole lot. The new book is called Bone Shepherds. And we live in a bloody time. So I think a lot, you know, the explorations of kind of personal rage, particularly in the second book, but also in the first book, they become bigger, and I start asking questions about what does it mean to have a legacy of rage? What does it mean to have one of love? But there is one poem in here that does have to do with race. I moved to Austin in August for the year. And it was, I mean, I've lived no more than a half an hour outside of metropolitan New York pretty much my entire life. So living in a city that was so clearly segregated by race and by class was astonishing to me and terrifying, to be honest with you. I mean, I'd experienced things before, mostly when I was much younger, but to consistently walk down the street and have people cross to the other side or to have people kind of clutch their purses a little bit closer. To have one person actually find out that I wrote books and ask me, do you write in English? And I wanted to say, yeah, better than your whole fucking family. Can you edit that out too, man? It was really astonishing to me. Now, there's a great diner right up the street from me called The Galaxy. And recently I went in, and I've gotten to the habit of praying again before I eat. And consistently, I am the only non-white patron in the diner. And it took me a long time to get used to that in Austin. This particular time, I was carrying a couple of books of poems, and I was reading them. My food came, put the books of poems down. There was an older white couple directly next to me, and I could feel them kind of staring at me and trying to check out like the books that I was reading. And the gaze became even more intense when I bowed my head and I started to pray. And I said to myself, they must be wondering to whom I pray and what I'm praying for. So that's what this poem is about. Oh, and Emily was saying that you had just read a short story about in the voice of a dog. This is a poem. How many of you read this Edgar story? Okay. So this is a poem in the voice of another canine, in the voice of a wolf. Wolf prays at the galaxy. For years, I believed I could lower my eyes and exult in nothing. Sometimes I can sit at a table in the galaxy, this diner in Texas, and without curse or guile, dip sweet potato fries into honey and salt. And because salt is a metal whose taste I love, this is how I pray. And though I walk upright, and though I carry books, and though I order sweet potato fries in the language of the Milky Way, my head must become long and lupine when my mouth meets the pleasures of cold water on the first 80-degree day of January. This morning is like most mornings here. The patrons are all white. All. What they know of me comes from legends. I'm the only wolf in the galaxy. One, you might say, who regards the night from the night itself. It's times like this I become certain of my solitude. Certain there's a kinder heart than the one responsible for the history of this scene. There is an old couple beside me. The man is a crane with a crane neck. His wife is a raccoon and raccoon necked. Their necks, I mean, are useless. Neither can seem to make out the open book of poems in front of me. Neither can imagine the wishes of a silent wild canine when he bows his canine head to close his canine eyes. Not them, not you, not one conceive of the dark, doggish god I name in prayer, or what bloody dance must be twined up in my hamstrings. Not one can fathom the lusty teeth of such wishes. This mad dog prays over sweet potatoes and salt. My God, look how crooked at the knuckles my hands. Some of us still believe the taste of freedom is an old iron. They set traps in all the wrong places. I will tell you this, though I am a beast who wishes for serenity, even for the dumb crane and the blind raccoon, my brothers and I, we nightly finger the tarsal scars of our escape. We refuse to die any other way. We feed ourselves among you. We refuse to lick our ankles until the old manacles rust through. Horace outlined what he felt good poems should do in his Ars Poetica. We've come to another time. This is what I, kind of my own American Ars Poetica. So it's a little bit of a longer poem. Ars Poetica, after a dog. Here is a sex shop and a Bible shop, two doors down. A sick hound roams between them. Let's suppose this. Now imagine a two-family house where three families live, across the street from a deli, and this check-cashing shack with a rabbit hutch out back. Any one of these has been burned down twice. So let's suppose this is America. And don't forget, there's Frederick the idiot who feeds that mean dog flowers. Imagine what kind of tribe we are, one who over chess and chit-chat might trade a mango and Jesus honey for knives. How we thank God Almighty that we don't know what it's like to be close to one another. Okay. Suppose we've pulled our heads out our asses just long enough to attend to some unfamiliar din, some bell on bone, some buzzsaw racket that bores the air a gurdy hum, and our numbers fill first a small stretch of spoiled turnpike or dried out meadow. What kind of sound, imagine, rallies us all from precinct to nook? What noise to muster tremors from St. James and Hustler alike? What uproar, what raucous fuss in every American vicinity? And I know you don't believe any human noise can call us all together per se. But listen, suppose we are moved, summoned, you, me, and the rest of us who want to know something about everything we've outlived. By hullabaloo, we gather, beckoned, not too far from the Triple X store and the Bible store, not too far at all for Frederick to carry in his sleeves the scent of mongrel, or bad cheese, or onion skin and cheap ink. And you, and I, and Frederick, and all stand elbow to elbow, this small throng of the ordinary, armed for once with our full wits. And no, let us not say it is a sin, but say this, this sound as we approach gets stranger and stranger, so much so we mistake it for ourselves, for it has the bony rattle of dice-quick wrists, the abundance of olives and lakeshore sand. It resembles a scripture and curse, you and I in dim-lit squares and dance floor muck, in crawfish mud and dance hall wine and broken bed and graveyard bliss have been grinding for all our lives. This joyful wind and rewind of body back down through through and into jubilance, so old no vector of bullet or blade could fleck the soggy pale neck of a boy offered to God. No, battalions of angels to save him. And what if this sound that is not a singing becomes one by one the lot of us? Us improbable, us gorgeously common, us tunes contagion. What if us do sing with sand caught in our teeth, mango dripping from our mouths, Jesus honey wild? What if the very knives start clanging too? What if those first no song strains open the sex shop neon in us, musk in us, whiskey stinks so deep down in us, we sing like this so funky, so loud, we refuse to neglect what ramshackle bunkhouse, penthouse, whorehouse we were drawn from in the first place, or how the hell we will ever find our way back. Even so, let's not forget the long yawp of the poor dog who ate fresh petals some moron savant fed it after he spent one whole spring week stitching them together with metal bars. What if no one recalls that sound, except the few surviving dogs, the twisted wire fence, and the silent magnolia blast every May? I say, let us not slip back through the dark to sting and peck our beloveds with more than our usual misdeeds. I say, let us not forget a sick hound's metallic hack and skirl, for Frederick has found a few more dogs to feed his barbed garlands to. And before we count ourselves among the blessed, let's say we ain't done yet howling into great tombs, ain't yet done cracking necks. Let's say this once and for all, for kicks, we won't taste sulfur at the end of a fuse. When one is born, when one dies, when one steals a moldy loaf of bread, this is how it is. The dildos go on sale, in the rabbit hutch, a snake. We've played checkers with the pawns, but if there were ever any lies, we shall let everyone know now what they are and who started them. Some of us will not get fed, but let's listen, spooning in the dark, for laughter. For if we're lucky, sometimes both the darkness and the laughter are our own. This is America. If we've no choice but sing in multitude, no better than the soul of a wrongly punished dog, may God for once not grant us a few more things so foolish as that, given the way we ruin our guts on rusted steel and blue. Thank you all for coming out. I don't know if you have to put chains on your tires or whatever to get out here, but I really appreciate you all coming out. My last poem. Making love to you the night they take your father to prison. There's got to be a chorus somewhere for the conjunction of honeysuckle and funk. A verse for the turn of your hips and the sling-back steel bar anthem banged out breathless over your father's small-time underhand hustle. A tune that begins in the skin's hi-hat quiver, begins with the lick of the fist or the thrum of a summer gust doubled in the brief sweet moan coaxed from your mouth and mine. We grind. Slow. Two bodies become one small song, scarcely loud enough to budge God and any three of his bloody saints. Baby, we are our own wine. We improvise the gorgeous toil, stillness, and motion against each other make. Bone on blunt bone, gleefully barbaric, call it blessed. We cull something like salt out of the seep of evening air immense, and rising like incense so stink, hellfire must work twice as hard to burn it into us, then once again back out. By dawn, you'll leave my finger between your teeth, and behind it, the last grief of the first man you've ever adored, on the verge of free. Sometimes the body in music unlocks its most ruthless interrogatives. And to this and the rest of the world tonight, I cannot stop saying yes. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Your turn. What's tonight? Thursday night? What are you guys missing? I don't even know what's on TV. Happy Day Salon? What's on Thursday nights? Thank you for missing your TV shows. You guys have questions? Comments? Yes?
I was just wondering, so it seems like a major part of your, the effect of your poetry is sort of having a rhythmic and sort of musical element.
tell you, one of the best gifts and rarest ones that I've had was to visit schools. I mean, one time that, one that stands out in particular was going to visit the University of Pittsburgh, where students were studying my first book, which is a gift to begin with. And the assignment that day for this undergraduate workshop was for students to come in having memorized any contemporary poet, a poem from any contemporary poet. This one young woman memorized one of my poems. I mean, if you ever go to the Strand bookstore in New York City, you'll see how many poetry books there are out there, and how many poems have been written. And for this one woman to pick my poem was unbelievable. She looked me straight in the eye, and she recited that poem back to me. It wasn't my voice. It was hers. And it was the best gift, you know? People mistake the passion with which I read my poems for a kind of authority about the way they should be written. That's not true. That's not true at all. I love the possibility of many voices coming to any poem, really. Coming to any poem. That was a beautiful gift that young woman gave me that day. She has her own music. I want to hear Britney Spears do one of my poems. Yep.
Just reading through a lot of your poems, they're all, a lot of them very contemporary. Sorry, just what's going on, what, just the subject matter.
Mm-hmm.
But I was just curious, you and I briefly talked about, things existing, episteme, things existing in a certain period of time. But in the present, I was just wondering why there seems to be a conscious decision, and maybe it's different years ago when you're talking about very violent time right now.
Mm.
But you do a lot of pop culture out, or just some stuff like very just contemporary issues.
Yeah.
Which might assume for yourself.
Yeah.
I just prompt you on that.
Yeah. The project of my first book, I grew up with a bunch of dudes who the only book they've ever read in their lives was mine. And I knew that they would read it just because I wrote it. But I also wanted them to be able to read a book that they would relate to, and a book that would challenge them. In order for them to relate to it, one of the things that is in the book is the shared vocabulary, or the shared references that they have and that I have. And it goes beyond me and the fellows that I grew up with, right? And in some ways, you can't even really select that. It's just you have these lexicons that you grow up with. And those are the lexicons that enter your work. Like in the way that when I'm talking to my buddy Hector Hernandez, like all of a sudden we'll just break out into some Spanish. You know, that's not always a choice. Sometimes it's the language that's most available to you and most appropriate for the particular moment. And poems do that too. Look, even those of you who didn't raise your hand when I asked you whether or not you spoke more than one language, you do. Each of you speaks many Englishes. You know? And I feel like one of the myths about writing poems is that there is a kind of English that only one kind of English that is rendered in poetry. That's such a false premise to write poems upon. Especially for Americans. I just came from Austin. I mean, just being on the plane, the difference in English between Austin and Maine. Right? Write in all your Englishes. Yes?
I just want to say that I think it's really great, really interesting that you give a backstory sort of on your poems, because I think a lot of the time, readings that I've been to, it's not really especially with your poems, you might be able to tell where your inspiration came from. You might be able to assume, but I guess I just wanted to say that, but also ask you do you feel that, do you like to do that?
Yeah, I do. I feel like, you know, there's a, you know, this kind of, this public forum for poetry, this poem in the air, it's much more ephemeral. It's like, it's on the air and it's gone. Whereas if you buy the book, you could have, it's right back there, you could have a much more intimate relationship with it. You can spend time with it, right? The backstory when I read out loud sets things up for you, for all of you as an audience, so that you can catch things that you might not catch in the air on first hear. If you spend time with the poems, you'll be able to kind of, you might not get the exact backstory, but there's enough to kind of engage you, I think, on the page that you can do that on your own. But when you're reading poems, you want people to get it as much as possible. I do anyway. Some poets are afraid of being understood. I want to be as clear as possible.
When is your next book for that?
Don't know. Probably, I'm at, it's all but done. So probably around 2010 or so. Yeah. When's yours?
Well, you should tell them that you've taken it back to do more with it.
That's right.
That's important for you to say. I was going to say, surely you're not going to mess around with those three parts. but I'm not, you know, that, I won't go there. But in any case, it's important for everybody to know.
That's right.
It's not just that you're slowly working, but you had it on the editor's desk and you've taken it back.
That's right. So, the book is completely written. I sent it to my editor, saw my editor in January. He's like, we're going to put it on the 2009 catalog, maybe 2010. And I said, Gabe, I'm pulling it from your desk. I have another project, which I was going to read from, but I realized I didn't have it with me. I have a novel in verse that I'm working on. And as a matter of motivation, what I told myself was I didn't want to publish this next collection of poems until I finished writing the novel in verse. And I also wanted this latest book, My American Quindiman, to have a kind of its own life in the world before I had another book come out also. So, yeah, that's the story. Yes?
One of the poems I wrote in life, and they seem to be sort of like one long unfolding, and you have these great extended metaphors that work their way throughout. Guises every time, like the liquid glass. Mm-hmm. And I wonder, you know, just speaking to the practice of writing poetry, do you tend to write those all in one sitting? They sound as though you do, but given how large the scope of some of those projects are, it's hard to imagine.
No, none of those. Even more so with long poems. Well, no, that's not true. It doesn't even matter the length. I'm always going back to poems. That the Ars Poetica that I read, which is a real tough poem to get out loud. I've been working on that for about a year and a half, and I just got it in its last iteration within the last few weeks. It's always been this kind of big sprawling poem, but I've been going back to it almost weekly. And I had this discovery, this kind of technical discovery. The poem now is a strictly syllabic poem. You heard how long. It's about 3 pages long. Every line in that poem is exactly 10 syllables. Every line. It tightened up the poem. It tightened the lines. It tightened the music. Images and a kind of ferocity entered the poem that I didn't have in earlier drafts. And it's tricky. I mean, you must know this, like, to work with such strict formal demands and not lose the soul and the energy of the poem, right? In fact, what we're trying to do in craft, like those of you who are taking craft and workshop classes, what craft is doing is should make the poem arrive closer to its soul, right? Not crafting, crafting it away. Craft is the discovery in the minuscule. I think Donald Hall said that in the beginning of my writing career, inspiration happened in the beginning of the writing process. The older I got, the inspiration started happening towards the end. I'm getting older. And I enjoy it. I enjoy it to maintain a kind of a long-term intimate relationship with a poem. Is so rewarding. It's so rewarding. It's as rewarding as that initial kind of rush and exuberance of the first poem, because you can, with the same poem, you can constantly rediscover, right? Rediscover your relationship to it and its relationship to the world. That's a gift too. To allow the language to let you to re-see things. There's not a whole lot of things, I think, in the world that allow you to do that. Yes?
Who do you get feedback from too well? You send it to your editor, but like, is there someone else you send it to?
Yeah, I have a couple of really close friends, Ross Gay being one of them, Araceli's Girmay is another, Curtis Bauer, and Ross and Curtis, I met in grad school. Araceli's and I have just been friends maybe in the last couple of years or so, but we're very, very close. And those are kind of like my initial editors. But then, when I was living in New York, every Monday night, I would go to Bar 13. They have the best open mic and 2-for-1 drinks. Best open mic in the city, maybe in the country. And I'll tell you why. Because the ear is an incredible editor. And to read it, not just out loud, but to read it out loud to a bunch of people, a bunch of New Yorkers, you know, the ear is a great editor. But Shame is an even better editor. So I have people whom I'm very close with, and I send those poems to, and then I make sure that I try out poems in the world, because that's where I want them to be. There's one other question. Yep.
So, in the practice of gift giving, my family, I'm not very giving. So, around Christmas time, I can give some stuff as a gift. My mom bought herself this thing called Amazon. It's called like a Kindle. But it's sort of like you open it up and it's a screen. You can download books onto it.
Oh,
so,
yeah.
I just had an idea just after used to hearing the saying with someone else's voice. And I'm thinking a lot about mixing media. And if there were to be a book in which something like that, in which you could record, and you had the option of reading it and but like playing it at the same time. Would you consider doing that? Just I'm basing that off of
you mean like saying, with my voice?
Yeah, just because
I love that. Way. Yeah, I love that idea. In fact, I love the idea of like what would be really cool is to like create a website or some kind of DVD or like some media where you would have my poems and maybe a recording of my poem, but then you could record your own voice or your own arrangement of my poem to make it truly kind of like, was it Coleridge who said it is what's half created and what's half perceived, right? Was that Coleridge? Wordsworth, sorry. Who's one of those guys? Keats is my man, I don't know who that is. You know, it's that partnership in the making of the poem, and that whereas technology can seems to be so demonized for kind of destroying the most human things about art. I think there are ways that it can possibly enrich that too. You know? Yes.
A loaded question. Do you think you had your voice already when you started playing?
No. No, not it. Yeah, not in any real, I didn't know what it was. And in fact, it probably didn't happen until a couple of years after my MFA when I started gaining some confidence, real confidence in knowing what my voice is. And to be honest with you, my voice, it's changing. You can probably hear it a little bit in this new book. Like I'm definitely doing some, there's some stuff that's residual from the other two books that hold it together, but my voice is always changing. I'm an immigrant's son. I'm the son of two immigrants, and I'm an American. And we've crossed ocean, literally, and continents to get here. There's no reason why I shouldn't have many voices. That's just historical, you know. And so I don't think that I'm ever going to stop exploring all those different voices. Thank you all so much for having me.